This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss eye health as we age with ophthalmologist Dr. Natasha Dang. We'll find out about mother-daughter relationships with mother and daughter authors Lindsay and Leslie Glass. We'll discover how a yoga practice can help foster resilience with yogi James Leslie Christoph. And lastly, we'll learn how stem cell treatments can help cure CTE with Dr. Eric Weiss. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Scientists at McGill University and the Douglas Institute have found that two specific types of brain cells show clear changes in people with depression. The study, published in Nature Genetics, offers new insight into how depression affects the brain and could lead to more targeted treatments for this common mental health disorder, which impacts over 264 million people worldwide. Using brain tissue from the Douglas Bell Canada Brain Bank, researchers examined thousands of individual cells from people with and without depression. Through advanced genetic testings, they discovered that two types of brain cells, excitatory neurons that control mood and stress, and microglia, which manage brain inflammation, show major differences in gene activity among those with depression. This finding gives scientists a clearer understanding of where and how brain function is disrupted in depression. Depression isn't just emotional, it reflects real, measurable changes in the brain, said lead researcher Dr. Gustavo Torecki. The team now plans to study how these cellular changes affect brain function and explore whether targeting these specific cells could lead to more effective treatments for depression. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Natasha Dang in a moment. But first, a little bit of business. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. Dr. Natasha Dang is the medical director of Oakville Laser Eye Center and a leading expert in laser-assisted and refractive cataract surgery. A fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, Dr. Dang is known for combining cutting-edge technology with a deep commitment to personalized patient care. She's also a respected voice in the field, contributing to the education of her peers and advancing surgical techniques. At the forefront of vision correction, Dr. Dang leads her team with an unwavering focus on patient safety, outcomes, and experience. Welcome back to the show, Natasha. How are you?
I'm good, Jamie. How are you doing? How are your Patriots?
Well, you know, it's one of those transitional seasons, right?
Absolutely.
You know, Vrabel has them working. That's going to be the case, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Co-Patriot fans here. So last time you were on the show, we spoke about glaucoma, but we're going to approach eye health a little bit differently this time around. We're going to talk about it from beginning, I won't call it to end, but as we get older. Does that sound like a plan?
Yep, sounds great.
So let's start with early years. Why is it so important to screen children's vision early, even before they start school?
Children can't tell you if there's something wrong. Part of it is, you know, sometimes they're too young to articulate it. But even more fundamentally, they don't know what's normal. So if you're someone who's born with a prescription error or you're born with blurry vision, you've never seen clearly, you don't know that other people see differently than you do or that their world can be more in focus. And so often vision problems in young children are not detected until they go to school. And they're often identified as behavioral difficulties, problems with attention, problems in school, learning disabilities. Often it's not noticed until, you know, they're in a classroom and they can't see the board as well as another child in the class can. And it's really important to identify vision issues in children early, because those early years are extraordinarily important. There's so much rich development happening in terms of neural connections between the brain and the eye, and you don't want to lose out on that critical period for development.
Oh, that makes sense. What are some of those common eye problems that can be missed in children if parents aren't making sure that the kids are getting their eyes checked?
I think the big three in terms of children's eye problems that we commonly think about is we think about eye crossing, yep, like eye muscle problems. We think about cataracts in babies and children.
Oh.
And we think about prescription errors. And I think the first two, cataracts, usually the parent will see that there's a white spot in the pupil, or the pediatrician will notice it, and that'll prompt an assessment. Eye crossing, I think most parents will notice that in their children. They'll seek care. So those two conditions tend to be caught. The one that kind of gets away from you and can get kids into trouble is prescription errors that go undiagnosed, because they're invisible to the naked eye. The parent would never know that the child has a prescription error. The child will never tell you that things aren't in focus. And those are the kids that I think are really at risk of having poor outcomes in terms of their lifelong vision potential.
Are the types of things that arise in small children, is that more hereditary in nature or not?
Some of it can be. So, for example, if we're talking about prescription problems, yeah, if as parents you have strong prescriptions, it's more likely that your child is going to be similar. So if you're very nearsighted, you're more likely to have a nearsighted child, and vice versa if you're farsighted. But why this is so important in children is, again, like if you're not in focus, those connections are just not forming and they cannot be rebuilt later on.
I understand there's something called myopia management in kids. What exactly is that, and how's that different from just prescribing glasses?
Prescribing glasses brings the world into focus, yeah, but it doesn't change or alter the rate of progression of your prescription.
Ah.
And nearsightedness in particular is something that is epidemic in children. We really saw it take off during COVID. I think it had been trending in that direction anyway, but huge explosion in it in COVID, and it's sort of ongoing. Kids are at devices all the time. They're usually not on phones. Some of them are, but they're definitely on tablets.
Yeah.
And they're indoors a lot. And those two things contribute to becoming increasingly nearsighted. Being nearsighted isn't great for a number of different reasons, quality of life reasons, dependence on contact lens, spectacles, less options in terms of surgical options down the road, risk of ocular health issues like glaucoma, retinal detachment, cataract, et cetera, is higher. So it's something you want to try to prevent a child from becoming overly nearsighted if you can.
Okay. Let's jump ahead to young adults. For those who don't want to wear glasses, you know, because what the stigma of wearing glasses, or for whatever reason, what are the differences between laser vision correction, implantable contact lenses, and refractive lens exchange?
The eye is basically a series of lenses that focus light to allow you to see clearly and be in focus. And sometimes we are born with eyes, or we have eyes that develop in a way that doesn't focus the light where it should. And we treat that in a few different ways. So you can treat the eye, like you can treat a prescription error in the eye by putting extra lenses in front of the eye. That's glasses or contact lenses, which I think most of us are really familiar with. But you can also surgically treat the eye itself to address prescription errors. And there's three ways in which you can do this. So one, you can change the shape of the lens in the eye. So you can, that's laser vision correction. That's what it's doing. It's changing the shape of your cornea.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you can add an extra lens to the eye. Mm-hmm. And that's very cool. That's an implantable contact lens, essentially. And it's just a lens that you slip inside the eye. It's great results, quick recovery times, and it's entirely reversible, which is interesting about it. And then the third is you can do refractive lens exchange, which means changing the lens inside the eye, just changing it out for another one. So it's all about playing with that system of lenses and kind of using the physics in your favor to achieve the result you want.
So as a specialist, how do you decide which of those routes is the best way to go? Like what are the factors?
Top two factors are your eye shape and prescription, as well as your age. So if you're kind of 20 to 40, we're going to be thinking somewhere between laser vision correction and implantable contact lens. A lot of that will depend on the shape and health of your cornea and your eye, as well as the strength of your prescription. So milder prescriptions do really well with laser vision correction. More moderate and even really high prescriptions can be treated with implantable contact lenses. I should say refractive lens exchange, I typically will only consider that over 40 at the very earliest. And usually once someone starts to become dependent on reading glasses, that's when we start to think about it.
Why? Is that one the most invasive?
It's not that it's the most invasive. It's just the right timing of it. So Okay. Essentially, the lens inside the eye ages as we get older.
Right.
So usually around the age of 40, it starts to become a little stiffer, less flexible. We start to need reading glasses more.
Right.
And then by the time we reach our 50s and onwards, it starts to become less transparent. It becomes a little bit more cloudy. That's a cataract. And most of us end up having cataract surgery. So if we get close to the point where that lens isn't functioning as well as it should, then we want to start thinking about treating the lens. So if someone's 40, 50, 60, you start thinking about things like refractive lens exchange, because what it's doing is it's replacing that lens that, you know, has started to work suboptimally. And this person might be maybe a decade or two, like a decade away from cataract surgery. Now, if they've had a refractive lens exchange, they don't need to have cataract surgery. But you don't want to do that in a 25-year-old who's got a perfectly transparent lens that has flexibility and natural accommodation. We're not going to take that away.
So in that cohort, like middle age, is it the stiffening and the opaqueness that are the changes, or are there any other physical changes to the eye that sort of will tell you which way you want to go?
I think those are the big ones, and that's really what prompts people to come in. Mm-hmm. I find, you know, once you get into your 40s, that sudden need to buy a larger phone, like a phone with a larger screen size, or need reading glasses. For some people don't mind. Some people find it incredibly annoying. And that's typically the point where I start to see people in their 40s and 50s coming in saying, like, what can you do? How can I get rid of these million pair of glasses?
You know, you probably see more lawyers in your practice, because like I had like perfect vision, and then I went to law school and I was practicing, and you just read so many cases, and you're online, and you're in front of the computer the whole day, and I still am, even though I'm not practicing, and my vision has gotten so much worse over the years because I'm in that cohort now.
There's actually a number of studies on lawyers and what happens to their vision, and absolutely your experience is like, it's anecdotal, but it's well supported by studies.
Okay. I'm on to something.
You are.
So what are the changes that are most common? Have we sort of identified those, or are any that we missed for people in my cohort?
Dryness, I think, is something that's not talked about enough.
Oh my God. Lately it's been driving me crazy. Yeah. So why is that? What's happening?
So our eyes become more dry as we age. Lifestyle factors contribute too. So we're all on our screens all the time.
Yeah.
When you're looking at a digital device, you're not blinking as much. Your eye does become more dry. Kind of in artificial environments that may be a little bit less humid. There's like artificial climate kind of conditions. There's more dryness. If you've had previous surgical procedures, you take medications. All of these different things can contribute to eye dryness. And we don't think enough about it, because it really, really can harm your quality of life. It's like, I have dry eyes, and when they are troubling me, it's really annoying. It's hard to focus on other things.
It's happening now.
Do you?
Yeah, right now, as we speak. Natasha, which
I should have brought you some drops.
I was going to ask you, like, what sort of eye drops should I be, horrible pun, focusing in on? What should I be looking for in an eye drop?
Non-preserved artificial tears that are non-medicated, that's your mainstay foundational therapy.
Okay.
You want to be using that not only when you feel dry, but get ahead of it when you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other things you can do as well. And there's even sort of more durable in-office treatments that you can look at if it's very bad. But dry eye can definitely be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And not only can it and should it be treated, it helps you get the most out of your vision, whether you're post-surgical or not.
I mean, it's getting to the point where it's so bad that I have dry eyes even like when I'm sleeping, which is crazy to me because my eyelids are shut, right? And I can still feel it, like I'm waking up. So I got to get on top of this. Let's switch gears. Enough about me. Let's talk about cataract surgery. And last time you were on, you mentioned refractive cataract surgery. Can you walk us through what the difference is between refractive cataract surgery and other cataract surgery?
Absolutely. Cataract is a medical condition where the lens is no longer transparent, it's blocking light, your vision's no longer correcting to 20/20, you might be experiencing glare and halos. It's a medically necessary procedure to remove the blur from the visual axis by taking the lens out of the eye and putting a new clear lens implant in. That is really what cataract surgery is all about. When you start thinking about the focusing power of the eye and reducing your need for glasses, not only at far, but maybe at far, computer, and near, and trying to do all of those things, that is when it transitions into being refractive cataract surgery, because you're now trying to achieve a specific vision outcome that is all about quality of life.
Light adjustable lenses are getting some attention. Can you explain how those work and why it's considered a breakthrough?
Light adjustable lenses are a newer category of lens. It's a silicone-based lens that we implanted into your eye, and then it's adjustable. And the patient and the surgeon work together to fine-tune the end result to what you want, essentially. It's groundbreaking. I do agree. I think that's the right word for it. I don't want to be hyperbolic, but I've never in my career seen a technology that puts control and ownership in the hands of the patient. I think that's really unique. It lets you test drive your vision and, you know, fine tune it, adjust it to exactly what it is that you want to see. And where we find it really beneficial is some of our refractive lens exchange patients are opting for it, as are refractive cataract surgery. And why it's especially popular is that you can actually, in some people, achieve less dependence on glasses for far away and for up close without some of the compromises we had to make in the past with glare and halos and things. So we get really excellent optical quality. And so it's been a really nice option or offering for some people who are good candidates for it.
Time for one last question. If someone's thinking about cataract surgery, what questions should they be asking their surgeon to make sure they're getting the best outcome for their vision and lifestyle?
If you haven't had a conversation with your surgeon about what you do, what you used to do, whether you drive, what time of day you drive at, what your hobbies are, you haven't had enough of a discussion to move ahead with surgery. It's really important for me as a surgeon to know what it is that you like to do. I don't like to make assumptions. I'm never surprised anymore, but I operated on a 79-year-old who wanted to know when he could go kite surfing.
Wow.
I operated on somebody recently who wanted to know when he could lift 600 pounds. You know, this is not what you think of your typical traditional like cataract cohort of patients. It's people live their lives differently now. And I'll even have some patients say to me like, oh, I don't have any specific vision needs. I live a very domestic lifestyle. But even if you like to watch TV and crochet during the commercials, I need to know that because that's flipping back and forth between two zones of vision.
Right.
And I have to plan for that so that you're not flipping glasses on and off because you won't like that. So those are all things that are, they may seem sometimes not important, but we actually do need to know about them so that we can make a good recommendation for you.
So it's like watching the Patriots on TV and then flipping to your phone and during the commercials, right?
Second screen, right? Everybody's doing second screen and you have to think about that.
There you go. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Natasha Dang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Does your reflection match how you feel, or are stubborn areas holding you back? At Form Face and Body, they specialize in restoring your youthful glow and sculpting the body you desire so your outer appearance reflects your inner vitality. Visit formfacebody.ca and see how they can help you rediscover your confidence. Call 416-447-6176 to schedule your complimentary consultation and reclaim your vitality. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Leslie Glass is a journalist, recovery advocate, and the author of 12 books, including 9 USA Today and New York Times best-selling suspense novels. She's the co-founder of Reach Out Recovery and co-producer of the award-winning documentaries The Secret World of Recovery and The Silent Majority. Lindsay Glass is an author, screenwriter, and co-founder of Reach Out Recovery, where her writing on relationships and wellness reaches millions worldwide. She co-produced The Secret World of Recovery and The Silent Majority and is the author of 100 Tips for Growing Up. Both Leslie and Lindsay live in Florida, and for more information, you can visit reachoutrecovery.com or connect with the authors on Facebook at Reach Out Recovery, Instagram at Reach Out Recovery, and YouTube at Reach Out Recovery 6052. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having us.
We're delighted to be here.
Okay, so you guys are together in the same room. No fighting today. We're all going to try and get along, right?
We're going to do our best. We promise.
Okay. Today we're going to talk about mother-daughter relationships. And I got to tell you, mother-son relationships are fraught as well. But you guys have a special dynamic that you want to talk about. So what is unique about mother-daughter relationships and what makes them so potentially ripe for conflict?
Ooh, there is so much. And it really begins with, first and foremost, control. Because moms are the ones who birth you and they're responsible for you. And then there's this very natural process that goes on between mothers and daughters where the daughter has to become independent. And that is a dynamic that is meant to have some conflict. So already right there, it's fraught and it can just go so wrong for so many reasons.
Another issue is that moms are moms for the first time, and they're using their own mother's models, even if they don't want to, or they don't like their mom. It's hard to undo that blueprint.
Yeah, and then there's so many trigger issues that come up between mothers and daughters that are just so much about independence, growing up, and who the daughter is growing into and whether mom likes that or not.
So the two of you actually weren't speaking for a number of years. What were the issues that you had that sort of brought the disagreement about?
Well, first of all, I would say that we were relationship experts who couldn't manage our own relationship.
Of course.
And that we basically came from a dysfunctional family. So trying to get along and manage our business, our making movies, and also having the issue of addiction and dysfunction in the family.
Yeah, it started young. And I think that's really important. When you have kind of a dysfunctional family system going on and you grow up with bad communication styles, and we're talking about fighting, blaming, people who are not able to listen, that is something that can really create a foundation for a very troubled dynamic between a mother and daughter if they're not able to really be able to understand each other.
Right. And even though we went into recovery, and we both went into recovery, we still were not able to manage that fighting habit that we had. And I must say, Lindsay took off. She ghosted me and she took off. And for 4 years, I was a mom who didn't have my daughter in my life. And that is a devastating experience for any mother. But if you're sharing a business, it's even worse.
Did your problems predate the business, though? It sounds like they might have.
Oh, absolutely. They started really when I was a teenager. That's when our fighting habit began. And what's fascinating about recovery and our recovery journey was we both did find lots of forms of recovery, but we were not able to change the dynamic that we were in. So even though we had worked on ourselves, we were both sober, we were still treating each other in a way that was decades old. And that's what we had to examine in our separation and then find tools for us to be able to come back together and treat each other in a new, respectful way.
So those were the issues that were unique to your paradigm. What do you see in other mother-daughter relationships that lead to discord?
We did a lot of research around this, and we found 8 biggest issues that pretty much any mother and daughter are going to fight about. And they include food and weight, money, independence and control, appearance, romantic partners and friends, boundaries and detachment, and then, of course, the big ones, if your family is dealing with mental health, alcoholism, or addiction, those are situations that are going to throw the entire family out of whack. But if you think about your family, your children, any family, think about the fights that happen just trying to choose what's for dinner, just trying to choose the curfew, just trying to choose who are appropriate friends. I mean, it is ripe for conflict.
And this is also true with fathers and sons.
Absolutely.
This is not only mothers and daughters. So although we write about mothers and daughters, it's really all relationships have these same conflicts and same issues.
But the types of things that trigger conflict when, you know, kids are like in their teens versus when they become adults, right? Like, you know, your brain forms, you get older, you know, you're not going to still be upset about curfews when you're in your 20s. It's more about, you know, where the relationship is based on what happened previously, right?
Well, here's the thing. I was still very, very angry as an adult over the things that had gone on in my childhood. So even though I wasn't arguing with her about, you know, curfews, the rage that I had felt that was unhealed from childhood was still playing out in the adult relationship. And I would say, and Leslie, you can speak to this, if anyone has parented a child with addiction or other issues, even though I was sober, she was still parenting sometimes like a parent that was trying to have too much control. Does that make sense?
A parent who is trying to, and Lindsay, you talk about control, and I would say a parent is trying to keep a child, even an adult child, safe. I think adult children, parents still see them as younger, even if they're.
Well, I think a lot of parents can infantilize their children.
Absolutely.
And I think there was some of that in our adult relationship. So that needed to be looked at.
Like control over money.
So I think sometimes parents, even though the child is an adult, it's hard for the parent to change the dynamic. It's hard for them to see them as an equal or a responsible person, particularly if they haven't been.
I think one of the other things is that moms always are having to learn how to let go.
Leaving aside sort of the issues that come up that create discord, isn't it also about the people as well? And, you know, what kind of communicators they are and, you know, how they cope with their emotions, whether they have a high EQ, you know, how they conduct themselves. Isn't that a big part of it?
I'm so glad you brought that up. That is exactly what we were talking about before we got on. So the issue is anybody can fight. It doesn't really matter. You can be aggressive. You can be passive aggressive. Everybody has the potential to be difficult. The question is, what is your emotional intelligence? Where is that at? Are you able to read the room? Are you able to do active listening? So we know very difficult people who are able to listen. And we know lovely, friendly people who couldn't be more difficult because they can't read the room and their behavior is not, it's not appropriate. They don't know how to be accountable. So that's what we think conflict comes out of. More than personality type, it comes out of somebody's ability to have some self-awareness about themselves and the other people who are around them.
And to be able to manage their own emotions. I mean, to be able, if I'm mad at you, for me to be able to control my emotions and really look at myself and say, what is triggering me? What's making me angry here? Is it me or is it her?
So let's lean into the triggers for a sec. In your experience, what are some of the things that actually lead to the conflict? We know what the topics of the conflict are, but what's really causing the conflict?
There's so many things that can happen. So being dismissive, constant nagging or criticism, even body language. If somebody walks in the room and looks at you with a disapproving look and you know it's about what you're eating, that conflict has already started just by the way somebody's looking at you. And, you know, whether it's disagreement from curfews to what we're having for dinner, it's the conflict of wills, you know, and who's going to win. And I think, you know, the triggers are really different. When you have a teenager, and we write about this in the book, it is actually a trigger when you are a parent and you are working hard, you are providing, you are exhausted, you've had a long day, you're keeping this family running, and a teenager walks in and says, I don't want that for dinner. I don't want to do my homework. I don't want to. And you feel instantly thwarted. You know, that's a trigger for a parent. So, you know, there are teenage triggers and then there are adult triggers, you know, asking adult children asking for money, mom.
Or asking you to do things you don't want to do, or not having boundaries about coming into my house or going through my clothes. I mean, there are many, many kinds of triggers that you can have in daily life, thousands.
Time for one last question, and that is, what are some of the tools and techniques that people can learn to avoid falling into the trigger trap and getting into fights?
Absolutely. And this is the whole point of the workbook, right? Because we explain what all of these things are, conflict, triggers, trauma, but it doesn't matter unless you have tools. So what we put in the workbook are everything from replacement scripts. So if you realize you're in the habit of nagging or criticizing somebody, we're going to give you actual scripts to replace the things that you've been saying with new ways that are positive and supportive. We're going to talk about self-awareness and give people writing assignments that help them really learn what they're trying to, you know, figure out in the relationship. The other thing we really talk about is learning to pause, not react and respond every single time a thought comes into your head, really learning to listen and hear what someone is telling you. So all of these things are tools. We have interactive pages throughout the workbook to actually give people the practice they need to implement these new activities and learning tools.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
It was fun.
That was Leslie and Lindsay Glass. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss yoga for resilience on The Tonic. Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
James Leslie Christophe is a Montreal-based yoga instructor, personal trainer, and resilience coach who rebuilt his life after incarceration. Through yoga, fitness, and breathwork, he discovered the tools to transform adversity into strength and now helps others do the same. He shares his story and his teachings to inspire resilience in leaders, communities, and individuals navigating stress, reintegration, or personal growth. Welcome to the show, James. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for receiving me. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well today, which is a high watermark, James. You haven't been on the show before. Usually I'm a glass half empty guy. So if I'm doing pretty good, that's almost a high watermark. The water may be totally full in the glass. So you haven't been practicing yoga all the time, have you? How did you come to your practice?
Actually, it was my physical practice happened 2 weeks after my release. I got incarcerated in 2020. The day COVID started, I got incarcerated. And I got out May last year, 2024. Upon my release, long story short, I was looking into some things online, and I fell into a school for intensive program of yoga, and I just applied and I did my 6 weeks, 200-hour course, and I started teaching from there. But if we go back to my incarceration, it's all about reading. I was reading all the secrets of this world, all those books on self-development, and I fell into. I'm more of a psychology and logical guy, so I fell into reprogramming of the subconscious by Joseph Murphy and The Keys of Mastery by Charles Hanno. And it was pretty, I felt it related to me and the behavior of how I was thinking. And I was looking at a way to fall out of that victim mentality. I was always angry. At the first 2 years of incarceration, I did 4 years and a half. I was really a problem. I was angry all the time, fighting all the time. I was a problem. And at some point, you get tired of being tired. I was hitting rock bottom and I wanted to change. And I fell on those books. Daily exercise, weekly or daily, about breathing, mindfulness. And slowly but surely, I started calming down and I saw that it worked. I was interacting with my dad on the phone. He sent me a few yoga studios because as I was learning from meditation and breathing, I found out that pranayama is part of yoga. So I started writing letters to a few yoga studios and one hit me back. And we started having exchanges for a few months. He explained to me like how yoga works, the eight limbs of yoga, and what it would do for me. He could help me when I got outside. So yeah, this is how yoga found me more than I find yoga.
That's interesting. When you were incarcerated, were others doing yoga while they were incarcerated? Is there anybody sort of practicing mindfulness while in the prison? I'm curious.
From my perspective, no, there wasn't, because I was there for a violent crime, so most of the time I was in a maximum, so I was with people like me, like short-tempered, like impulsive, so they weren't really into mindfulness. I went around a few jails because I got transferred a lot because of my behaviors, and a lot of time yoga was advertised, like a few other rehabilitation program were advertised. But none of them fell through either because of COVID or lack of personnel or whatever reason they want to give you. But rehabilitation is really not at the forefront of the judicial system, but that's another conversation. But it was advertised a few times. Even when I went to at the end, I went to the penitentiary. They had meditation classes when I first got there, but it got canceled. I think they had a few classes, then it got canceled. For whatever other reason they found not to do it. But no, there's really nothing. When it came to mindfulness or switching your mind state, there's really nothing. But a few places they have program like violence program or AA for the alcoholics, like if you want to attend, but you really have, it's really about doing the work yourself. They're really not gonna do it for you.
What is it about yoga that resonated with you?
It's the practical aspect of it, like always, like right now, I'm a personal trainer too, so it's easy for me because I've been working out since I'm a kid. Like everything that has to do with sport or physical movement, like I know and I'm interested by it. But when it comes really to your mind and your breathing, nobody really teach you nothing about that. And from being incarcerated, like I saw that my breath is what helps you relax. Like being in the present moment makes you feel better, clear your mind, and it's something that you have to do regardless. You have to breathe, but we're just not conscious about it. So even if you're in a confined place, it's something that you can do. Or wherever people are, in their car, in a real life situation, that's what resonated with me because I could actually change my thought process. Because when you're inside, especially, you're always like in a fight or flight mode. And me, I'm not somebody who likes running, so I'm always in the fight mode. I'm always prepared for the worst. So being able to breathe and be conscious about my breathing, that really helped me deprogram my patterns of thinking and just being the observer of of the situation you're in and really go from there. So it helps you not being impulsive and really detached from the situation. So that's really what helped me a lot going through the process.
Do you think that yoga would have resonated with you before you were incarcerated, like in your former life? Do you think you would have recognized that, or did you need to go through the process of sort of the penal system in order to recognize the changes needed to be made?
Honestly, like if I look back at it, like prison really saved my life because I was living 100 miles an hour. And I didn't, if you asked me 10 years ago about yoga, I would have said, okay, some other girl thing, girl wearing Lululemons, or I wouldn't even approach that. But after doing it, it's really, even when I got out, like I was in a teacher program, I was the only man. And nobody knew my story. I didn't tell them I was fresh out of jail. Like at the end, I told them at the end as we created bonds and we were friends, but nobody knew my story. So it was kind, to me, it was like vacation. I'm like, hey, I'm taking a class with six other girls. I haven't seen a woman in like 4 years. So, but no, just before that, no, I was too self-centered. I was in a survival mode, like most people, like get your money, pay your bills, and get buy more things. So no, I wasn't really into yoga like that.
Let's talk about how yoga helps you with stress, discipline, and emotional balance now. So, what do you feel like? What are you leaning into? What parts of the practice are you finding the most benefits?
Me, it's really meditation. I made it part of my routine. When I get up, don't look at your phone. I look at my phone to know the time, but I mean,
Yeah.
put my phone on the side. I try to do a 20-minute meditation. If I got to get up earlier, I get up early. Like it's really important to me. It helps to focus on what I need to do for the day. I don't like to wake up and be in a rush and be in a constant rush all the time. So with the stress release, with really meditation, breath work. Breath work, it doesn't take long. 2, 3 minutes of breath work, whatever you feel stress helps me. Just being mindful, slow down, be at peace, don't react. It's always about the observer effect, like step out of the situation, look at it from a different perspective. When it comes to discipline, I'm always been disciplined. Like I set up the routine and I was more into sports. So I'm all about doing something even if you don't feel like it. So once the discipline is there, it's like wax on, wax off. You do it without really knowing when you're gonna need it. And now it just become a habit of, now I'm stressed, I just start bringing it a different way. I don't even have to think about it and not on stress. Or I'm being mindful about the moment. I can walk and look at a tree and like, oh, that's a beautiful tree. I'm not rushing to my car. So it becomes a habit that your life is different. Emotionally, it gives you the space to be vulnerable with yourself. It gives you time for yourself, introspect, time to breathe. Like after a long time incarcerated, like you have a lot of guilt and shame about the things you did and the things you made your family and loved one go through. So it helps you like accept the fact you can't change the past. You can't control everything. I'm specifically somebody who likes to control my environment, control everything. So when I'm not in control, it kind of mess with my mind. Doing yoga and like slowing down and being more mindful, it helps me with that. Like really, detachment and equanimity is really something that comes a lot in yoga. That's equanimity, is the samadhi at the end of the practice. And I think that's really the part that would help most people, is to detach from the outcome of things. Just enjoy the journey.
So you've been through this yourself. Do you think that yoga can help others who've been incarcerated, whether it's during their incarceration or when they're being reintegrated back into society? Do you think it would work for others? I guess is really the question.
Yes, definitely, because I relate to so many stories. Like you always think you're unique. Like what changed my life about reading is like when you read, and you read, I read psychology books and such, you realize that all that research has been made. So all those people are just like you. People are going through the same thing, same stuff. You think you're unique, but you're really not. Like everybody has the same kind of traumas in their type of way. So going back to helping others, yeah, it helps with the stress because when you get out, nobody wants to say it, but being released is stressed out. You're confined for so many years. I was confined in a cell that was as big as my bathroom when I was outside for years. So you get out into this big world, you're still in your fight or flight. You're like, you didn't regulate your sympathetic nervous system. Like I remember my first time I went to Walmart with my sister, I had a panic attack. Like I had to tell her, like, give me the keys to the car. I went to the car and I started breathing. Like I couldn't have that many people around me. Like it's chaotic because when you're inside, everything is in order. Like you get up at this time, you go out at this time. If you work at this time. You wait for your food. There's a line to go in. There's a light to go out. When you're out, people walks everywhere. They bump into you. They don't say you're sorry and this and that. You're not used to that interaction. So like you really need something, a way out to breathe and to calm yourself down.
I agree with you, but I can tell you, as somebody who's never been on the inside, I don't enjoy the Walmart experience either. So you're not alone there. If that makes you feel any better. I don't like being jostled. I don't like being around a lot of people who are like milling about and getting in my way either. So I'm with you. You know what? Thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain your situation. I think it's a really different and unique perspective.
Thank you very much. Let's make the world a better place together.
Agreed. That was James Leslie Kristoff. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss stem cell treatments, or CTE, on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. This cold and flu season, discover the power of medicinal mushrooms. Rich in antioxidants and known to naturally support your immune system, medicinal mushrooms are one of nature's most powerful defenders. Trusted by Canadians for over 20 years, CanPrev Natural Health now offers medicinal mushroom supplements. Every capsule combines both fruiting body extract and mycelium, providing the full spectrum of medicinal compounds for a full spectrum of benefits. Gentle enough for daily use so you can stay supported all season long. Now available at your local health food store.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Eric Weiss is a leader in advanced regenerative medicine and the co-author of Educating Marston. Founder of the North Florida Stem Cell Clinic, Dr. Weiss provides stem cell replacement therapy to treat various conditions such as osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, and traumatic brain injury, with a special focus on the treatment of autism. Welcome to the show, Dr. Weiss. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So down there, it's football season. Up here, it's hockey season and I guess basketball season in full swing. And there's renewed attention to concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. For listeners who may not be familiar, what exactly is CTE?
CTE, like you just said, stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And it's always been interesting, but it really came to the forefront probably a decade or two decades ago, where you can have a concussion or even a subconcussive blow, and then 20 or 30 years later be three times more likely to have dementia or Parkinson's disease. And so what they found out is that a series of small blows can lead to a secondary injury that is devastating. And that's essentially what chronic traumatic encephalopathy is.
Right. And, you know, you hear it in the news with usually, I mean, unfortunately, with ex-NFL players, right, who you know, take
Correct.
All kinds of collisions. And then, you know, perhaps, you know, you hear about their weird behavior or you know, they act out or they get aggressive. And I understand that can happen with CTE, right? Like you kind of lose your primary sort of executive thinking skills, correct?
Correct. It's a true dementia, and a lot of times a paranoid behavior. The suicide rate is very, very high. The abuse rate, aggression to your spouse, family members, all high, but all because of abnormal brain function.
Well, you're the doctor. Can you explain what happens inside the brain after repeated head impacts and why it can lead to long-term damage?
Well, certainly any traumatic brain injury, when the brain gets hit or the skull gets hit, there is a disruption to the brain. For a classic brain injury, car accident, hitting the head with a hammer, whatever it is, it's easily to see there's a contusion, there's bleeding, there's loss of tissue. When it's minimal, it's not easy to see, but microscopically, it is there. But what happens with a traumatic injury, and especially a concussion, or what we call a minimal TBI, MTBI, is that there is an initial injury, but it sets up inflammation. Without getting, you know, too far into the weeds, the body's response to a brain injury is to kind of wall it off, set up an inflammatory process. Special types of cells called glial cells can kind of eat up the dead tissue and then help restore the brain. But it looks like with repeated traumas, that switch that turns off the inflammation is never turned off. So they get this chronic inflammatory response. And unfortunately, in that response, these cells secrete factors which kill brain tissue and disrupt connections. And so you get this prolonged ongoing injury that ends up being, you know, 1,000 times worse than the original injury.
So we've covered CTE on the show before in terms of preventative measures. We had an entrepreneur on who had designed a particular helmet for hockey players, for example. And we've talked about cannabis as a potential treatment. But you're here to discuss something very different. Your specialty is stem cell therapy. And I'm really interested, how does that come into play in terms of treatment for CTE?
And you're right. The whole thing about traumatic brain injury is prevention and rehabilitation. And those were the two main factors. And there was never a thought that you could alter the pathway after the initial injury. But when we found that there is this inflammation, everybody was focused on how do we control this inflammation? Because if we can control and turn off the inflammation, then we can limit the damage and rehabilitation would be easier. So they actually, there was a bunch of trials. You know, we know how to turn off inflammation in the knee joint by giving steroids. You know, some sex hormones help turn off inflammation. A bunch of other drugs turn off inflammation. You can watch TV and hear everything from, you know, arthritis to eczema, and all those are right. Anti-inflammatories.
Right.
But nothing really worked. And so most people don't realize we've been using umbilical cord blood and its stem cells in medicine in the United States for 60 years. There's 80 different diseases that it's the primary treatment. And they've noticed that it has broad anti-inflammatory action. And so they did a study in laboratory animals where they did a specific brain injury and then gave them human umbilical cord blood and human stem cells. And it turned off the inflammation. But the most important thing is not only did it turn off inflammation, it turned on neurorestoration. And what they found out was these cells, these glial cells, which are the ones inflamed, they actually can have, they have two active states. And they're called the G1 and the G2. Mm-hmm. And the G1 is pro-inflammation. Let's destroy, let's gobble up, let's take away what's hurting. And the G2 is let's secrete factors which promote brain health. And you actually make new connections, and it calls your own stem cells that lie deep within the brain to migrate to the area and take over. So now there's actually enable not only to limit the injury, but actually treat the injury and have people get better than if they just had rehab alone.
So you just referenced umbilical cord stem cells. And I, you know, what little I know is you can harvest all sorts of different sorts of stem cells. What makes the umbilical cord stem cells particularly useful for healing the brain?
First of all, they're easy to harvest. So we're talking about live, healthy births in the United States. This is essentially what's considered surgical waste. And so nobody wants it. And it turns out it's a huge depository of stem cells. These stem cells are actually adults. People get confused between adults and embryonic stem cells. So embryonic stem cells are usually derived from a fetus. But after about two, maybe halfway through the second trimester, you know, the fetus is done developing. It's just growing. And then you have something called adult stem cells. And adult stem cells are designed to heal, not to make new parts. And so they migrate to inflammation and show and have the ability to heal. It has been shown that these stem cells so early on in life have better healing capacity than stem cells you might find in the bone marrow, like yours and mine. You lose these stem cells very quickly. By the time you're done your teenage years, you've lost 90% of your adult stem cells. By 35 years of age, you've lost 95%. You know, mid-50s, 97.5%. And then on and up until once you're in your 80s, you essentially have lost the capacity to heal.
So how safe and effective is stem cell therapy for people living with CTE or even just long-term effects of concussions?
Well, first of all, it's very safe. We have a 60-year history of not only the donors, but also the product itself. You know, and the product itself does not come with no risk, but it's about as low as it can be. Certainly, you know, the mothers are tested for HIV, you know, human T cell leukemia virus, hepatitis A, B, and C, you know, anything that could be transmitted blood-wise. They're screened for genetic issues as well. But in the studies, they're really the downside is it doesn't help, but no long-term side effects.
Like anything, I'm sure there's sort of questions of cost and access. So, beyond professional athletes or those in the military who, you know, may get CTE, do you think this therapy could be standard treatment for anybody with those types of brain injuries or lesser brain injuries?
Oh, I believe it should be. You know, I think any traumatic brain injury, even a concussion, a simple concussion in a high school football player or a slip and fall, we know that as we get older, our risk of falling and people get subdural hematomas. It's already been shown that stem cells and rehabilitation is better than rehabilitation alone. So it should be standard care, and I hope it becomes standard care.
Is it being used in care, or is it just at the research stage at this point?
There are clinical trials going on. I think that University of Miami down here in Florida, they have something called the Miami Project, where they're trying to cure paralysis, but they do a lot of brain injuries as well. But they have many trials going on.
Last question. Just given everything that's going on in the world, and I'm thinking in particular of all the cuts to research in the United States, where do you see the future of brain health going, particularly in you know, with this use of stem cells for CTE? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think people are looking for different things than big pharma, you know, and you have to remember this is something God made. This is something that was designed in us to migrate to inflammation and heal. And I believe umbilical cord blood and its stem cells will be the biggest advancement in medicine since antibiotics. You know, and it may take 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years, but this will be something that can help everybody.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was great being here, and I'll come back anytime.
Fantastic. Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Natasha Dang, Lindsay and Leslie Glass, James Leslie Kristoff, and Dr. Eric Weiss. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic Newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic Newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.